TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. A Farewell to Justice. Jim Garrison, John F. Kennedy's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison was the only public official to have indicted a suspect in President John F. Kennedy's murder. Biographer Joan Mellon met Garrison in 1969. His relentless search for the truth about who killed President Kennedy made a deep impression upon her. In 1997, 5 years after Garrison's death, Mellon started to work on the story of his life. Her biography turned into a new investigation of the assassination itself. Joan Mellon spoke in New York in January 2006, a few weeks after the release of her book, A Farewell to Justice. She found new evidence in the National Archives JFK Assassination Records Collection and conducted more than 1,000 interviews, with many witnesses speaking out for the first time. Joan Mellon names those responsible for the assassination and shows how the cover-up began in New Orleans months before President Kennedy was shot in Dallas. Here is Professor Joan Mellon.
Thank you very much for coming. The last time I was in this room was for the memorial service for J. Anthony Lucas, who is one of our most distinguished writers, the author of Common Ground about Race and Class in Boston. And Tony, during the course of his distinguished career, had a considerable conflict with one of the institutions that I'll be talking about in a few moments, the New York Times. When I come into this room, of course, I think of Tony. My book is about the Kennedy assassination. It began as a biography of Jim Garrison. For those who don't remember and who don't even remember Oliver Stone's movie, he was district attorney of Orleans Parish, a place that no longer exists. And he remains the only public official ever to have brought anyone before the bar of justice for participation in the conspiracy to murder President Kennedy. Garrison assumed that role because he discovered that the person framed for the crime, a low-level intelligence agent named Lee Harvey Oswald, resided in his jurisdiction between April and September of 1963. The biblical metaphor is inevitable. That great harlot city, New Orleans, destroyed by flood, with among its many sins, incubating the Kennedy assassination. After his suspect Clay Shaw was acquitted, and Clay Shaw was the man whom the new evidence reveals was a CIA operative guilty of participating in the implementation of the murder of President Kennedy, Garrison was asked how he imagined he could convict someone of conspiracy in the murder of President Kennedy in a Louisiana state court. Garrison said, "I guess I thought I was living in the country I was born in. He wasn't, and we aren't." I'd like to suggest that the truth about the Kennedy assassination, far from being a matter of interest only to historians, and not even to most of them, will help us understand how we arrived at a point where people as respectable as New York attorney Martin Garbus are comparing the current U.S. government with the rise of fascism in the mid-20th century. It's my belief that the present state of our political culture is a direct result of the fact that those responsible for the murder of President Kennedy have never been brought to justice. To sum up, A Farewell to Justice suggests that the clandestine service of the CIA not only covered up the truth about the Kennedy assassination, that's easy to demonstrate from the 4 million documents now residing at the National Archives, but organized the event itself. That the CIA escaped without penalty, this extraordinary fact has been integrated over these 42 years into the body politic. It has produced a political culture where the unthinkable has become accepted practice. Meaningful freedom of the press has fallen into serious jeopardy. For a flagrant example of what we have come to, we might revisit the scantily reported exchange on December 1st between Notre Dame professor Doug Castle and John Yoo, a former deputy assistant to Attorney General John Ashcroft, a participant in the writing of the Patriot Act, and now a Berkeley law professor. The subject of the debate was the illegal expansion of presidential powers. Professor Castle asks, if the president deems that he's got to torture somebody, including by crushing the testicles of the person's child, there is no law that can stop him? And you answers, no treaty. Castle follows up, also no law by Congress? That is what you wrote in the August 2002 memo. And you replies, I think it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that. If Professor Castle's hypothetical question seems melodramatic, we have Martin Garbus, alarmed by the twin expansion of presidential and police powers, writing in the New York Observer, quote, this country is approaching a dangerous turning point, and suggesting that the United States today bears some similarities to Weimar Germany, where liberal democracy was not able to contend with the fascist onslaught. In Miami a few weeks ago, I was struck by the omnipresence on the streets and restaurants of police officers from a variety of law enforcement agencies. Famously, Benjamin Franklin replied to a question of whether this new land should be a monarchy or a republic with the line, a republic if you can keep it. What begins as surveillance moves to wiretapping, then COINTELPRO tricks, and finally to murder. A diagram of what happened to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and why the illegal NSA surveillance is so alarming. We have not been aided in understanding the meaning of the Kennedy assassination by the continued public silence of those closest to President Kennedy. One day I requested of one of Jim Garrison's law school classmates, Tulane School of Law, class of 1949. Is Wilmer Thomas here tonight? He called me this morning and there he is. Wilmer, hi. I asked Wilmer to ask his acquaintance, Kennedy advisor Arthur Schlesinger Jr., whom he believed was behind the assassination of President Kennedy. Professor Schlesinger observed quietly, we were at war with the national security people. That the CIA at its highest levels exacted its revenge on President Kennedy has been an open secret since 1963. A Gallup poll on the 40th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination in 2003 found that twice as many people believed that the CIA was implicated in the assassination as there were who accepted the official fiction that Oswald had acted alone. In 1963, people were already worried about the CIA's extraordinary use of its powers. In the New York Times, Arthur Kroc wrote in October 1963 that if ever there would be a coup in the United States, it would, quote, come from the CIA and not the Pentagon. The CIA, Kroc wrote, was a malignancy on the body politic. It is difficult to imagine such words being printed in the Times today. So profoundly has our freedom of the press eroded since the time of the Kennedy assassination. After the death of President Kennedy, ex-President Harry S. Truman, under whose watch the CIA was created in 1947, wrote on the front page of the Washington Post that the CIA had been running a shadow government, becoming operational. Truman declared that the CIA was in urgent need of correction. Brazenly, Alan Dulles at one point even told a reporter, Alan Dulles, of course, was director of Central Intelligence, even told a reporter to think of the CIA as, quote, the State Department for unfriendly countries. The CIA's policy making also involved interference in the electoral process in France and Italy, funneling money to certain political parties. In Italy, it was the Christian Democrats, whom the CIA funded in an effort to prevent a coalition of socialists and communists from taking power. The assassination of Prime Minister Aldo Moro was connected to that CIA campaign. At the time of the assassination, Charles de Gaulle remarked that John F. Kennedy, whom he admired, had died as a result of an intra-government conflict, a situation not uncommon in many countries. The documentation available since the passage of the JFK Act in 1992 overwhelmingly supports de Gaulle's view. The rubber stamping of the Warren Report by the press in 1964 seems to mark the moment when the mainstream press became embedded in official versions of events. Traces of that process have surfaced. In April 1967, the CIA issued a memo, available now at the National Archives, I wish the New York Times would read it, instructing friendly reporters on how to reply to challenges to the Warren Report, recommendations that have resurfaced in the past few years in a renewed set of attacks on Jim Garrison a decade after his death. So it should come as no surprise that the New York Times for a year covered up the National Security Agency domestic surveillance of citizens with rubber-stamped search warrants issued under a, quote, Foreign Intelligence Services Act run by the Pentagon, or with no warrants at all. Only when their own reporter was about to publish a book detailing the evidence did the Times run that story. It should be horrifying that the congressional debate about the Patriot Act has been not whether there should be a government capability, but how long it should be extended. Ponder the Times treatment of Jim Garrison and later of Oliver Stone, who dared to make a film with Jim Garrison as its central character. When Garrison's first book, A Heritage of Stone, appeared in 1969, John Leonard gave it a positive review in the Daily Times. In his final paragraph, Leonard recounted a few of Garrison's challenges to the Warren Report. "Something stinks about this whole affair," Leonard writes. "Why were Kennedy's neck organs not examined at Bethesda for evidence of a frontal shot? Why was his body whisked away to Washington before the legally required Texas inquest? Why?" By the next edition, Leonard's final paragraph had vanished. A third of a column slid down the memory hole. And one of the people Jim Garrison liked to invoke often was George Orwell. And in fact, he nicknamed one of his investigators Winston Smith. Of course, most people didn't recognize where the reference came from. Leonard's review now closed with these words: "Frankly, I prefer to believe that the Warren Commission did a poor job rather than a dishonest one. I like to think that Garrison invents monsters to explain incompetence." It was an extraordinary example of management censorship of a book review. To this day, as I said, the Times tolerates no factual challenges to the Warren Report. They appear to be the only people who still believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was responsible for the death of President Kennedy. I spoke in Clinton, Louisiana last month at the oldest working courthouse in the United States. The judge who introduced me asked the audience how many people believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was guilty. Not a single hand went up. The audience knew the Warren Report was nonsensical because it was in East Feliciana Parish, in the little hamlets of Clinton and Jackson, that Oswald appeared in the company of Clay Shaw and a CIA contract pilot named David Ferry, played by Joe Pesci in Oliver Stone's movie, in the late summer of 1963, 3 months before the assassination. In the audience were actual witnesses, including the barber who cut Lee Harvey Oswald's hair. That the Warren Report could so flagrantly lie and present itself as a homicide investigation while doing virtually no investigation at all, neither Clay Shaw nor David Ferry were interviewed for the Warren Commission, inspiring Jim Garrison's quip, "They didn't call anyone who was involved," has resulted in other presidential commissions taking similar liberties with the truth. I wrote an op-ed piece comparing the deliberate ignoring of crucial information by the 9/11 Commission with a similar failure to investigate a key lead by the Warren Commission. It began with the information released by Lieutenant Colonel in Army Intelligence Tony Schaffer that the Able Danger Intelligence Unit had identified Mohammed Atta, I'm sure people know about this story by now, and other accused hijackers as part of a cell of Al-Qaeda operating in the United States at least a year before 9/11. Colonel Schaffer had wanted this information to go immediately to the FBI, only for Defense Department lawyers to forbid Able Danger from contacting the Bureau. The New York Times buried this extraordinary information two-thirds of the way into the paper. The Washington Post ran a Pentagon denial. Information has to get out, and I think we have to account for why some of these things weren't looked at as part of the overall report, Colonel Schaffer said on NPR. Schaffer then revealed something else. He had presented the findings of the Able Danger team to Philip Zelikow, that same executive staff director of the 9/11 Commission who has defended the recent attacks on Jim Garrison as a dupe of the KGB. Zelikow saw to it that the Able Danger information never appeared in the 9/11 Commission report and went on to deny that he was given the information. He now works on the staff of Condoleezza Rice. One might ask, could Zelikow and company have gotten away with denying the reality of a cover-up of vital information about 9/11 if we had demanded the truth from the Warren Commission? I sent my op-ed piece to 34 newspapers. Only one would print it, the Key West Citizen. What has all this to do with the Kennedy assassination per se? I'm suggesting that demanding the truth about the Kennedy assassination, even at this late date, is a step toward restoring our basic freedoms. The discourse needs to go even further than pointing to who planned and who implemented the crime. Was the CIA acting alone on its own behalf? Well, whose interests did the agency serve in 1963? Because the CIA, eviscerated by George W. Bush, was a very different institution from the agency that waged war against President Kennedy. The discussion of who rules America must begin with President Eisenhower's, and you'll forgive me for repeating this, warning against a military-industrial, and we need, of course, to add national security complex. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes, President Eisenhower said. Eisenhower cut the military budget as soon as he took office. The CIA, the research reveals, sabotaged President Kennedy's effort to achieve détente with the Soviets in the final year of his presidency through the downing of Francis Gary Powers' U-2 overflight into the Soviet Union. President Eisenhower had a good definition of national security. He said, national security meant that the country was proceeding in peace and without a deficit. Jim Garrison often asked during his investigation, cui bono, who benefits? A lawyer friend of mine living near Langley Forks in Virginia pointed out to me some interesting connections. The Texas School Book Depository, from which some but not all of the shots were fired on November 22, 1963, was owned by one D.H. Byrd, B-Y-R-D. Byrd also founded and was the commander of the Southwest Post of the Civil Air Patrol, which included Louisiana and the troop led by David Ferry, among whose cadets was Lee Harvey Oswald. In November 1963, one of Byrd's companies, I think he had 50, LTV, a major defense contractor, was almost bankrupt. Defense contracts flowing from the Vietnam War changed that, and by 1968, the stock had increased geometrically in value. Meanwhile, we know that President Kennedy opposed vehemently a protracted ground war, and that as soon as he was dead, Lyndon Johnson dispatched thousands of troops to Vietnam. Among D.H. Byrd's associates was a man named Neil Mallon, the Skull and Bones classmate of Prescott Bush. Mallon headed a company called Dresser Industries, and it was Dresser which sent George H.W. Bush, his friend's son, west to Texas in 1949. It was from Mallon that the first President Bush named one of his sons. Mallon built Byrd's barite plant in Mexico, barite a product involved in oil drilling. By the way, I got an email today talking about the Mexico holdings of two companies, Halliburton and Schlumberger, both of which figure in the story. Dresser Industries was bought by Halliburton in 1998, and at that time the Kellogg subsidiary of Dresser became part of Brown & Root. Brown & Root itself had been bought by Halliburton in 1962, the year before President Kennedy's death. It is less well known that Brown & Root profited not only from the war in Iraq, but first from Vietnam. Having recognized the role of Brown & Root and discovering that George Brown was a CIA asset, as the CIA's own released documents confirm, Jim Garrison hoped to investigate Brown's role. Was the CIA acting on behalf of President Eisenhower's military-industrial complex? As a matter for further research, the intelligence connections of the Bushes date from before the very founding of the CIA. The agency's mandate was outlined in 1946 by Robert A. Lovett, who was a partner of Prescott Bush at Brown Brothers Harriman. Not least, as readers of The Nation magazine know, and many I hope are here, after the Kennedy assassination, the FBI was enlisted to brief CIA asset George Bush. And by the way, the first President Bush always denied when he was appointed Director of Central Intelligence that he ever before had a role in the CIA. CIA was briefing the George Bush and not a low-level man in the agency by the same name, as was at first claimed. On the reaction, the topic was the reaction of the Miami anti-Castro community to the Kennedy assassination. To the general observation that the CIA represented the interests of the oil defense industries and the Pentagon must be added another motive for the involvement of the CIA in the assassination. Almost from the moment Kennedy took office, a conflict raged between the president and the CIA. Once Kennedy refused to be blackmailed by the CIA into a full-scale invasion of Cuba at the time of the Bay of Pigs, de Gaulle's inter-administration war erupted. The clandestine service of the CIA pushed for an invasion of Cuba. President Kennedy declined and went on to fire the Director of Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles, who reemerges as the central figure in the Warren Commission. We all know that. Throughout Kennedy's brief presidency, the CIA treated him as an enemy. They withheld information, which included details about the Soviet missiles in Cuba. Also concealed from President Kennedy were the CIA's continued assassinations and attempted assassinations of foreign leaders. John F. Kennedy, in turn, sought to rein in the CIA and to limit the scope of its activities, including reducing the powers of the Director of Central Intelligence. He intended to transfer the Overflight U-2 program from the CIA to the Strategic Air Command. He intended to cut the CIA budget. He sent, I discovered, Richard Goodwin down to No Name Key to ask the Soldiers of Fortune training there to take over Radio Swan, the CIA station, on behalf of the president. They declined. And one of the Soldiers of Fortune down there said to, his name was Gerald Patrick Hemming, said to me, John F. Kennedy was the last president who thought he could take power. Kennedy threatened the existence of the agency as they knew themselves. Richard Reeves, in his very honest biography of John F. Kennedy, quotes the president repeating over and over again, I've got to do something about those CIA bastards. Those CIA bastards, I'm going to get those bastards if it's the last thing I ever do. It was the persistent refrain of the Kennedy presidency. The current president has also had his conflicts with the CIA. He, however, has espoused the very policy favored by the CIA under Kennedy, the relentless pursuit of foreign wars. To achieve his end, that war in Iraq, no matter what lie he had to tell to implement it, George W. Bush had to do what Kennedy knew he had to do as well, eviscerate the CIA. So the disinformation was spread that the CIA had fallen down on the job. In fact, the CIA had reported accurately about the situation in Iraq, and this before the Iraq War. CIA noted that an invasion of Iraq was likely to lead to civil war. The CIA reported that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Rather than give up his war, the president undercut the CIA. Then Bush attempted to subvert the CIA further by claiming that the CIA had endorsed what it had not, but which fit his projected policy. He claimed that the CIA had told him first that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Then he said CIA had been wrong. Neither claim was true. The outcome was the subordination of the clandestine services and of the agency itself, so that the CIA director no longer enjoys a daily briefing with the president and is subordinate to a new director of national intelligence whom the president can control. We should not be surprised that the National Security Agency, empowered only to spy on foreign agents abroad, is spying on us instead. Research into the Kennedy assassination reveals that although the CIA was supposedly created to deal with foreign threats, the CIA operated together with the FBI in the cover-up of the Kennedy assassination. Documents reveal that this mutual cooperation dates from the moment of the founding of the CIA. In Louisiana, the sabotage of Garrison's investigation was led by the CIA, operating beyond its mandate domestically. Let me return to some details of what Jim Garrison accomplished. As Garrison once quipped about the supposed lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, in fact, Oswald was virtually never alone. Moreover, he was not involved with anyone who was not connected to the CIA. Oswald was an FBI informant, Garrison learned from Louisiana Representative Hale Boggs, a member of the Warren Commission. And Garrison always said that the person who turned him on to the investigation of President Kennedy's death was Senator Russell Long. And people often criticize Garrison of talking to the press too much. And in fact, Garrison kept his secret until the day of his death. The person who involved him in the Kennedy investigation was not Senator Russell Long. In fact, I talked to Senator Russell Long's family, and Garrison always talked about a plane ride that he took with Russell Long in which they discussed the Kennedy assassination, and Russell Long convinced him to investigate. Well, what Russell Long's family told me was that when Russell Long got off the airplane, he said Garrison chewed his ear off about the Kennedy assassination. So the truth was the reverse. And one of those Soldiers of Fortune whom I just mentioned told me in Miami, the one true thing you said was that nothing is as it seems. It was Hale Boggs, obviously. Hale Boggs, a member of the Warren Commission, who had been at secret meetings, closed sessions of the Warren Commission, which talked about Lee Harvey Oswald's status as an FBI informant. And Alan Dulles told him, don't tell anyone about this. And Hale Boggs, of course, told Jim Garrison, and that was what really persuaded him to begin. I discovered a conversation Garrison did not know about. At the first district police station where Oswald was taken after he was arrested for a disturbance when he was handing out his pro-Castro leaflets. And by the way, the documents reveal that the Fair Play for Cuba, which Oswald supposedly represented, was heavily infiltrated by CIA. Those documents are all available at the archives. Oswald requested of Lieutenant Francis Martello of the New Orleans Police that Martello call the FBI field office. Call the FBI, Oswald ordered Martello imperiously. Tell them you have Lee Oswald in custody. Oswald asked that Special Agent Warren DeBruys come down to see him. Obviously, Oswald was someone the New Orleans field office of the FBI knew well. The agent on duty that night, John Quigley, then asked a young clerk named William Walter, the person who took Martello's call, to check all the files, locked and unlocked, for what they had on Oswald. On one file jacket in the locked filing cabinet of the special agent in charge, where security files were kept, were two names, Lee Oswald and Warren DeBruys. To this day, Mr. DeBruys denies that he ever knew Oswald, and he's testified as such to many committees. So just before my book came out, I called him up on the pretext of how to spell his name correctly. Do you spell D-E with a capital D or with a small d? And I was waiting, would DeBruys say anything after all these years? And what he said to me was this: after 40 years, you wouldn't be a very intelligent person if you didn't change your mind about things. Now, that wouldn't hold up as a confession in court, but I take it as one.
That was the first half of a one-hour talk by Joan Mellon, author of A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, John F. Kennedy's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. Joan Mellon is professor of English and creative writing at Temple University in Philadelphia. She's the author of 17 books, ranging from film criticism to fiction, Latin American studies, and biography. Come back for the next broadcast of TUC Radio, when Joan Mellon explains the extremely puzzling efforts by Bobby Kennedy to undermine the investigation into the murder of his brother. For more information, visit Joan Mellon's website at joanmellon.net. Mellon is spelled M-E-L-L-E-N. That's joanmellon.net. You can find a link to Joan Mellon's website on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. Come back for the second part of this talk when TUC Radio returns. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order an audio tape or CD of this talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gallardon. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.